This is special coverage of Inauguration Day 2013. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We're at the west front of the Capitol, where the president chose unity as one theme of his inauguration address.
America's possibilities are limitless, for we possess all the qualities that this world without boundaries demands. Youth and drive, diversity and openness, an endless capacity for risk, and a gift for reinvention.
The president and vice president, along with their families, have gone inside the Capitol building now. They're about to have lunch with members of Congress and other dignitaries, and then the traditional inaugural parade from the Capitol to the White House.
We'll be talking about all this and more in the next hour or so as our live coverage continues. The president also used diversity as a theme in his speech. He spoke of diversity as a strength of this country. One of the lines, "We were made for this moment," talking about how the diversity as well as the relative youth of the country can be tremendous strengths as the United States competes with the rest of the world. He spoke specifically of moments in civil rights history. He named three: Seneca Falls, that was a convention on women's rights. He talked about Selma, a moment in the civil rights movement for African Americans. And then he added Stonewall, a moment of gay rights. Before we move on, NPR's Scott Horsley, he said that and a few other things about gay rights. Have you heard him speak this forcefully on gay rights on such public occasions before?
Well, of course, he spoke out in favor of same-sex marriage last summer, and that was kind of a watershed moment for this president. And I think he now feels totally comfortable to address these issues in public. He made that move before the last election. If there was going to be a price to be paid for it, which some of his counselors perhaps thought there might be, it didn't cost him. And now he's liberated in a way to deliver that message more forcefully. It's interesting, too, of course, he was speaking just steps away from members of the Supreme Court who will be ruling on some very important same-sex marriage issues in this coming term.
And if we assume that this crowd is a reflection of the president's political base, that was perhaps the biggest cheer, definitely one of the biggest cheers, when he talked about our gay brothers and sisters enjoying equal rights, being equal to everyone else under the law.
It was so interesting, as you say, the way he did it, to link those movements, Seneca Falls, Stonewall, and Selma, as a part of a continuum and not discrete movements. That's not always been the way, for example, Stonewall has been seen. Not everybody has always aligned the women's rights movement and the rights for civil rights for African Americans. But this is what Obama so often does, is try to weave things that might be seen as discrete movements by certain constituencies into a larger picture that everyone can try to relate to.
And, of course, wrapping up by saying it is now our generation's task to carry on what those pioneers began. Again, like you said, using pioneers to link all of those different movements, using that term to kind of wrap that history together.
And the notion of a more perfect union is one that Obama uses over and over again. Not that we ever perfect the union that was first foreseen in the Constitution, but that we make progress towards it. At the end of his speech, he talked about 4 years hence and 40 years hence and 400 years hence, that project will still be moving forward.
And we should mention that is a common theme of second inaugurals, particularly if you read a number of them, they talk about the continuity of the country, all inaugural addresses to one degree or another. The question is, how do you plug in your own issues to that? How do you make it seem as though you are the man who is standing on the bedrock of tradition and imply that your opponents are not? David Wellner, NPR's David Wellner.
We heard some references to what may be President Obama's agenda in his second term. He did not specifically mention the gun legislation that is certain to come up very soon in Congress, but he did refer to Newtown, the Connecticut town where the 20 first graders were murdered. We didn't hear that much about immigration. He simply said that those who have come to this country have the same dreams that those of us who live here have, and it was a clear reference to what is on his agenda. It's an agenda that, in fact, many Republicans share as well, a recognition by that party that they have a lot of bridge building and fence mending to do with Latinos, and I think that's one issue where the president may find that there's buy-in from Republicans as well as from his fellow Democrats.
Unlike another issue that he stressed, climate change, that had a very prominent role in this address, despite the fact that was an issue that had a very difficult time in Congress, practically came to a standstill.
Well, maybe precisely because of that, he made a very stark and clear point about climate change. The Republicans who surround him, who are going to be in Congress these next 4 years.
Okay, let me refer briefly to the climate here. We're sorry to say that a sheet of clouds has come between us and the sun. It was a little chilly during the inauguration, which began actually a little early and kept a little ahead of schedule. The inaugural parade is coming up a little later on this afternoon. NPR's Linda Wertheimer will have a view of it. She's at the Canadian Embassy along the parade route, and she has seen many of these inaugural speeches in the past. Linda, as you watch the president, what stood out for you?
I think the references, my favorite reference in the speech, I think, the one that jumped out at me, was a pretty much straight campaign fare. That was, the American economy must rest on the broad shoulders of a rising middle class, which got a big cheer. And then when he talked about the little girl who is born in poverty, who should have the same opportunities as any other child, that she should be equal not only in God's eyes, but our own eyes. I think that was a moving part of the speech. But the thing that really impressed me, was because I have such a lover of Lincoln's second inaugural speech. I urge everybody to look it up. It's about a page and a half long. And it's beautifully written. It talks about the coming end of the war. But at the very end of the speech, where the quote, blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, mm-hmm. that was echoed in President Obama's speech. But if you look at the end of it, with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, talking about the care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and orphan, not the words, but the rhythms and the ideas, the sort of the thought of the end of that speech by President Lincoln reminds me very much of the end of the speech by President Obama, where he said, let each of us now embrace with solemn duty and awesome joy what is our lasting birthright, with conscious effort and common purpose, with passion and dedication. I think he must have had Lincoln completely in mind, and this speech completely in mind.
Scott Horsley, this is a man who has referred to Lincoln a lot, clearly thinks about Lincoln a lot.
Absolutely, and he also borrowed a bit today from Hillary Clinton. Linda mentioned his economic message, that the recovery depends on a broad middle class, a growing middle class, and he talked today about how the founding fathers didn't trade the tyranny of a king for either the tyranny of a mob or for an economy that benefits only a wealthy few. Well, Hillary Clinton said something about the tyranny of a dictator and the tyranny of a mob when she was talking about the riots in Egypt. So he's had a lot of inspirations, I'd say, to work with as he put this speech together.
And you also hear some traditional Democratic Party rhetoric when you talk about every person being looked after, every person having dignity, including, by implication, the very last and least of us. That's a Democratic theme going back generations.
Right, and he delivered a message here which I've heard him do before, but never in a prominent location, never with an audience of this size. When he talked about the protections that we afford to people don't inhibit initiative, they actually create the space for the kind of risk-taking that we need to prosper as a nation.
Now, as the lawmakers are heading into their luncheon, we actually want to go out to the mall where NPR's Jeff Brady is there. And Jeff, I was wondering if you could give us a sense of the scene there now as people are starting to disperse.
Sure. I was standing out. I found a little area where I could kind of get above the crowd a bit. And I looked away from the screen where everyone else was looking and looked at the crowd just to kind of see reactions from people as they heard the president's speech. And you could tell what issues were important to people. I cover energy. And one of the things that I thought was interesting is that he mentioned sustainable energy sources in his speech. He said, America cannot resist this transition but must lead it. That's going to be a boost for people who are concerned about the environment and who think that the country leads too much towards oil and gas. I also was looking at this one young woman. She's a student at American University. Her name is Eliza Bertrand. She's from Bloomfield, New Jersey, but she's here studying at America, and she studies film and media. And she cheered when the president called for equal wages for women. And then I asked her afterwards, I said, what what do you want from President Obama's second term? And this is what she had to say.
I hope in my lifetime, and I think I will see a time where gay marriage becomes legal in all 50 states, and anything that we can do to move towards that future in whatever ways possible, I think are very important.
You know, I have a few family and friends who live here in the D.C. area, and I talked to a lot of them. Are you going to the inauguration? A lot of them said, I'm staying as far away as possible because of all the traffic. But Eliza said she wouldn't miss this for the world. This is the reason she came to study in Washington, D.C., and there was no way she was going to be away from the inauguration today.
It's nice to hear from the voice of a young person. I remember 4 years ago, somebody coming up to me while I was reporting and trying to get people to talk to me. And a young woman wouldn't give her name, but she said, I hope President Obama will help me get a job. At the time, the economy obviously was the issue. But that sense of, like, maybe this is the guy who can make a difference. It's very interesting hearing kind of the shift in, priorities for people as going into the second term.
Jeff, go ahead, Jeff.
You know, it's interesting what you mentioned the economy there. And 4 years ago, everybody, that's the first, I talked to a lot of people on the street out in Colorado and all around the country. And that was one of the first things they mentioned was the economy. 4 years later, people are still mentioning that. I heard that from a number of people here on the National Mall today.
But Jeff, I want to ask the same question that I put to Elsa Chang elsewhere on the Mall a little while ago. The president, in his inaugural address, appeared to make a call to action to his supporters, that he would need their help to fight for his policies if he was going to have any chance in a divided Congress. Did you get a sense as you talked to people over the last several hours that these are people, and this is the president's base, we're looking at the president's political base on the National Mall, that these are people who are ready and eager to fight more for this president?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right that this is the president's base. I mean, there's very few. I haven't run into anyone out here who doesn't love Barack Obama. And there are certainly people who are ready to do things for him. I found people who were out canvassing in Iowa during the campaign. But when I asked people about, first I would ask them what they want, and then what stands in the way of that. They always say, "Well, it's the Republicans in Congress, and it's people making it difficult to and who won't work with the president." So I don't know if I suspect that people I've talked to are ready and willing to help the president, but they're concerned about all of the difficulties and the ability of him to actually do a lot during the second term because of all of the problems we've seen already.
NPR's Jeff Brady. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
Want to bring in some folks from our studio, Mara Liasson and Ron Elving. Maybe you guys can give us some context here about this second inaugural compared to that of President George W. Bush. You never know what you're going to get in your second term, as we learned from that administration. What can you tell us about what you heard in the speech versus what you heard back then?
The interesting thing, I think, about George W. Bush's speech in 2005 was how confident he sounded. He seemed very much to be a person who was, in contrast to his first inauguration, utterly secure in his office. Now, of course, when he was inaugurated in 2001, he had not won the popular vote. He had won the Electoral College vote. And there was a lot of unhappiness in the Capitol that day, and it was a miserable, rainy day and so on. But in 2005, everything seemed to be better. He was still feeling pretty good about the war in Iraq, although obviously some problems had emerged there. And he had big plans for how we were going to tackle entitlements and how, with the help of a Republican Senate and a Republican House that were more so because of his reelection in 2004, they were really going to run the town. So there was more of a sense of decided direction and the coach being in charge and on we were going to go. This was not that kind of moment. This was not this kind of inauguration. President Obama is certainly quite certain of his own views and where he wants to go, but of course he knows he has much more to deal with than perhaps George W. Bush realized he was going to have to deal with in 2005.
And, of course, the president also trying to stake some claim or trying to give us some idea of what his vision is for America's place in the world. Mara Liasson, I wanted to know if you could comment on that. I heard the word anchor when the president was sort of alluding to America's ability to be a force in the world.
Yes, and, he said we must be a source of hope to the poor, the sick, the marginalized. And he talked about human dignity and justice. I think he also made it pretty clear that he wasn't going to be mounting any new military campaigns around the world.
Right. I mean, using the word anchor, not leader.
Right. Anchor, not leader. And, you know, the interesting thing, the comparison to 2004, you know, President George W. Bush said very famously after he was reelected, I have some political capital and I intend to spend it. And it turned out that he didn't have as much as he thought, or else he spent it in the wrong way. But he kind of foundered on this plan to privatize Social Security. And the president, who has said famously, I have studied second terms and I'm very aware of overreach and we intend to avoid that. I think he has a realistic, sober kind of view of what he wants to accomplish and what he can accomplish. And he certainly laid out that agenda today, you know, whether it was immigration, climate change, preserving Medicare and Social Security, but doing something to have a prosperous, rising middle class. And I think that the big difference also, don't forget, is that when he was inaugurated the first time, the problems facing him were almost ungraspable. I mean, the financial crisis was so deep and so scary. And I think one of the reasons you saw everybody looking so happy today is this is just a better time to take office. Winding down two wars, the economy is growing again, albeit not fast enough. But it's nothing compared to the kind of crisis atmosphere that he took office in the first time, even though there was so much more euphoria about his inauguration in 2009.
At the same time, you did get a sense of a president trying to emphasize he has difficult battles ahead, really unpleasant and unpopular choices ahead. And he had a stronger, maybe even more than normal, a stronger defense of Medicare and Social Security. He was drawing a line essentially around entitlement programs and stating that he did not want to gut them as part of a larger budget deal of some kind. You had a president, Mara, who had a sense that in the next few months he has to do some very unpleasant work and there's no certainty that it will turn out well at all.
Yeah, and one of the other things he said is you know, you and I as citizens have the power and the obligation and the solemn duty to stay involved. And that's one of the things that he's hoping to do better than he did the first time, which is use his popularity, use public opinion to help him pressure Congress to get these things done.
And for Scott Horsley, I want to bring you back for a moment. Did this sound more like campaign rhetoric? I mean, that call to action, did it feel quite like we were a little bit still on the trail?
Yes, absolutely, and it certainly did. And one of the things he said on election night is, those of you who voted for me, your job doesn't end at the ballot box. Today he talked about not just the votes we cast, but the voices we raise, very much looking to keep people engaged. Of course, just this past week, we learned that he's recreating his campaign machinery as an ongoing campaign force.
David Wallner?
And I think that we've also seen the president with a couple of sort of victories that he can match as he ended his first term. The fiscal cliff showdown in Congress ended pretty much the way he wanted. Taxes did go up for the wealthiest, and that was what he promised in his campaign. And just now we had the House Republicans saying that they're willing to raise the debt ceiling at least through April. This was something that they had not been saying before. They've been demanding a dollar in spending cuts for every dollar that the debt ceiling was raised. They've dropped that demand for now. I think the president has a sense that public opinion may be on his side, and that's what he's going to work with.
Nevertheless, you have a situation now where the president has gone into the Capitol. He'll be having lunch with leaders of the House and Senate, Republican and Democratic alike. Many of the chairs are now empty in front of the west front of the Capitol. The music stands empty. The crowd's clearing out with quite a bit of rapidity from the National Mall, getting out of the cold weather as quickly as they can. We're going to do one more hour of live special coverage of today's events. Actually, several more hours, a whole day of special coverage right here on NPR News.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of Inauguration Day 2013. I'm Audie Cornish.
I'm Steve Inskeep. Here's the president.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability.
And will, to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend
the Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
The president being sworn into a second term of office before hundreds of thousands of visitors on the National Mall.
One of the main themes of Obama's speech, unity.
My fellow Americans, we are made for this moment, and we will seize it so long as we seize it together.
Coming up, analysis and reaction. This is special coverage of Inauguration Day 2013 from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The majestic sound of the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir leading into the moment millions across the country and around the world had been waiting for, President Obama's oath of office.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
At the U.S. Capitol, the oath was publicly administered by Chief Justice John Roberts, after Justice Sonia Sotomayor did the same for Vice President Joe Biden. And at a signing ceremony just moments ago, Mr. Obama formally nominated members of his cabinet. NPR's Don Gagne reports on what President Obama will confront as he launches into another 4 years.
More budget battles await the president as the second term gets underway. The recent year-end fight with Congress over how to avoid automatic across-the-board budget cuts left much work to be done on that deal in the first months of this year. The president is also pressing for legislative action on measures proposed last week to prevent gun violence, a pledge he made following the tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut. He has also placed fixing the nation's immigration system back on his list of top priorities. Meantime, there's a new cabinet to be built, including what could be contentious confirmation hearings for former Senator Chuck Hagel to head the Department of Defense. Don Gagne, NPR News, Washington.
The death toll continues to rise from Algeria's hostage crisis. The prime minister says 37 foreign workers had been killed since an Al-Qaeda-linked group raided a gas complex. The four nationals were from Japan, Britain, France, Romania, the Philippines, Norway, and the United States. British Prime Minister David Cameron says the UK will contribute intelligence and counterterrorism expertise to help defeat the Al-Qaeda-linked network that attacked the BP complex in Algeria. Larry Miller reports Cameron describes North Africa as a magnet for jihadists and says that threat needs to be met head on.
Cameron told Parliament there is a generational struggle taking place, and the fight is against an ideology that distorts Islam and promotes mass murder and terror as acceptable and necessary.
We must frustrate the terrorists with our security. We must beat them militarily. We must address the poisonous narrative they feed on. We must close down the ungoverned space in which they thrive. And we must deal with the grievances that they use to garner support.
Cameron says Britain will work with its allies to find and dismantle the militant network that planned and ordered the attack in Algeria. He promises a strong security response. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Militants say they attacked in retaliation for an operation in Mali. This is NPR. Forces from France and Mali are again in control of Mali's key town of Diabali. This comes after days of an intensive air operation against Islamist insurgents who had captured that town about a week ago. Afghan officials are still piecing together the details of a deadly clash with Taliban insurgents in Kabul today. NPR's Sean Carberry reports that five militants staged a pre-dawn attack on Kabul's traffic department offices and held Afghan forces at bay for about 9 hours.
Afghan police now say two men blew themselves up at the entrance of the offices to launch the attack. Three other insurgents then rushed inside with a mix of heavy and light weaponry. Gunfire and explosions rang out through the day, and by the time the clash ended, three Afghan police officers and the militants were dead. This was the second high-profile suicide attack in less than a week in Kabul, a city full of security checkpoints.
Yes, there are many checkpoints, but there's nothing like 100% guarantee in terms of security.
Brigadier General Gunter Katz is the NATO spokesman. He says that while concerning, these attacks don't signal a broader deterioration of security in the capital. Sean Carberry, NPR News, Kabul.
In Syria, the government is reporting a power outage that hit the Damascus area overnight and blaming that blackout on a rebel attack on the main power line that feeds into the capital. Residents, meanwhile, are saying the electricity went out late yesterday and returned to limited areas early today. Much of the city remained in the dark. State news agency again blaming rebels. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org.
From the West Front of the United States Capitol, it's special coverage of Inauguration Day 2013. I'm Steve Inskeen.
And I'm Audie Cornish. As we said, we're at the Capitol building. The formal public swearing ceremonies of the 57th presidential inauguration have wrapped up, and the president and the vice president are inside now, actually having lunch.
An hour ago, the president spoke to a crowd that filled the National Mall, and on this Martin Luther King Day, the president began by reciting the first words of the Declaration of Independence, that in early words anyway, that all men are created equal.
Today, we continue a never-ending journey to bridge the meaning of those words with the realities of our time. For history tells us that while these truths may be self-evident, they have never been self-executing.
President Obama then went on to tick through his agenda for the second term. He touched on gun control, gay marriage, and also immigration.
Our journey is not complete until we find a better way to welcome the striving, hopeful immigrants who still see America as a land of opportunity, until bright young students and engineers are enlisted in our workforce rather than expelled from our country.
The ceremony mixed politics with pop stars. Kelly Clarkson sang, James Taylor, Beyonce sang for the crowds who had waited for hours in the cold.
NPR's Don Gagne was there for all of it. He joins us now from the Lincoln Memorial. And Don, how did the crowd respond to President Obama's address?
It was interesting to watch here. This place has been bustling kind of throughout. Never particularly busy. A lot of people going up the steps, stopping where the engraving on the marble steps shows the spot where Dr. Martin Luther King delivered his famous speech almost 50 years ago. Then when the president started speaking, everybody sat down. They huddled around a radio in one corner. Other people looked at smartphones and iPads. And they sat on those cold steps, and they just listened.
I was going to mention that's cold marble out there.
Exactly. And there was no cheer, though you could hear the cheers from the other end of the mall coming from far away. But this is a very respectful place, and people seem to be kind of treating it as such. Of course, there are people who, prior to the president's words, were up inside the memorial reading President's second inaugural address, and were, you know, anxious to kind of see if this might be another one of that kind of gravity. People were certainly pleased with the speech, though.
Don, did you hear anyone talk about responding to any of these specific agenda items that the president brought up?
You know, there has not been a lot of kind of parsing the speech here, item by item. If I could describe what I'm hearing here, and I heard it earlier today, too, around the reflecting pool and around this area of the mall. Again, these are people, most of whom don't have tickets. Some of them are here because they thought Lincoln would be a great person to watch the speech with and listen to it with. Some were just here because it seemed like a good place to stop. But these are overwhelmingly, obviously, strong supporters of the president. And there seems to be kind of a joyful defiance, kind of that kind of a strain that runs through things. It says, you know, a lot of people said he was going to be a one-term president. I never believed it. We're still here. He's got a lot of work to do. We've still got a lot of work to do. That's what you hear from people.
And you're talking here, as you mentioned, to not the people with tickets up front. These are the more ordinary people that you would get, although obviously Obama supporters. And you say that you still find that kind of consistency of support for him today.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, some people mention education, some people mention the economy, some people would mention climate change and the environment, but the consistent thing is that they are very pleased that he is the one occupying the White House, who will be working with and obviously in many cases fighting with Congress over these issues. So it's basically there's a lot of work to be done in a lot of areas, and they're glad he's the guy who will be taking that fight.
NPR's Don Gagne is at the Lincoln Memorial. Thanks very much, Don. Let's go now to NPR's Sonari Glinton, who has been moving throughout this inauguration day. And Sonari, where are you now?
I'm at 3rd and D Southwest. For those of you who are not in D.C., it's like a couple blocks away from the mall. The groups are dispersing, and I'm trying to keep in tabs with my Chicago people.
Okay, and what did they think of the speech?
Well, unlike Don's people, the Chicago folks that I talked to, because I was deep inside of fur coat country, and they were longtime Obama supporters, and they had very, very specific things like gun violence. Everyone talked about Medicare, the debt ceiling. Like, literally, people with me were talking about very specific issues that they wanted the president to act on. And when he was giving a speech, there literally were dozens and dozens of amens after he finished the point.
Even after debt ceiling, is that usually not the term you hear after hearing about that?
Yeah, no. They specifically brought that up to me, like that it's important that he stand his ground. You know, Chicagoans often, you know, pay more attention in some ways to the minutiae of politics, and all of these people were informed about what was going on, and they were really interested in seeing, you know, what the president's going to do in the coming months.
Would you just remind us, for people who missed you earlier, what it was that these Chicagoans did to get here for the second inauguration?
Well, I took an 18-hour train ride from Chicago with a group of people who have been supporters of the president from the west and south sides of Chicago. And 18 hours is a long time, and they're talking a lot about politics. As one woman said, you know, there was a woman who was with us on the train who flew from California to Chicago to take the train for 18 hours, and then she said that she took a covered wagon from Western Virginia.
And what do they plan to do with the rest of their day, Sonari? They came all the way here. I can't imagine they're going to turn around right after.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I'm going to meet up with some Chicago high school kids who are just going to have a polite lunch and things like that. The older people, they're all running back to their hotels to get ready for inaugural parties. As one woman said, she's going to stay until the after set.
NPR's Sonari Glinton. Sonari, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And they mentioned the balls that they're planning to go to, parties they're going to, but actually it's kind of scaled down, right, Scott Horsley?
Well, it's scaled down in terms of number of balls. There are just two this year, although one of those is very large. So I think anybody who wants to make it can probably get there. But it is scaled down, and that was a nod to sort of the economic realities of the time, and also sort of, you know, we've just gone through a $2 billion campaign and a lot of celebrating that went on right after the election. And I think there's a little bit of a let's get back down to business feeling about this as well.
Let's bring in a couple of other voices now. NPR senior political editor Ron Elving, senior Washington editor, I should say, and NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson have been listening into our conversation. And I'm interested in picking up this notion of a partisan fight, which the president alluded to and which we've alluded to in our discussion here. I'd like each of you to know, as someone who's covered a lot of politics, how much worse is it today than it was in past years, if it is that much worse at all?
There are, of course, going to be dissenting voices on this, and people who were in Congress some years ago sometimes say, well, you know, we had some pretty tough fights, too. I think the difference is that now it seems to pervade every issue. It's not just two or three of the most contentious issues that make things get nasty. It's every issue. That we are at loggerheads in the House and Senate, that we haven't really had regular order in the Senate now for a number of years, which is to say the usual deliberative process, the usual budget process. process. These have broken down. In the House, you have what the party in control, the House Majority Party, saying, we're only going to bring things to the floor that are supported by a majority of our members. So things that might be supported by a majority of the total House won't even get voted on because they have to be supported by a majority, and that's really operatively usually an overwhelming majority of the members of the Republican majority in the House. So those are manifestations of what is a pervasive partisan atmosphere in which every member really, to a great degree, feels as though they have all become media personalities. There all used to be a few media personalities, of course, in any Congress, the committee chairs, the party leaders, and so on. But now, really, every senator, every member of the House has his Twitter feed or her Twitter feed. They have their Facebook pages. They have huge followings. They have people back in the district who think everything they do is right and righteous. And this has made it much more difficult to get all the members of Congress to sit down at some point and make a deal.
So let me just ask Mara Liason here very briefly, Mara. Given that partisan atmosphere, we've heard from the Obama supporters who liked what they heard and are hoping the president is going to fight. Did you hear any words from the president today that you interpreted as reaching out to Republicans in any way?
Well, sure. I mean, he said nobody's going to get 100% of what they want. We can't, he paraphrased, can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Look, you know, it's this cliche that says the American political system always does the right thing after they completely exhaust every other alternative. And I think we maybe were coming to the end of all the other alternatives. I mean, just if I could offer a little bit of optimism, I agree. Politics seems as broken as it ever did. And it's not just that the two sides can't come together, but that even you saw before the end of the year, John Boehner, the leader of the Republicans, can't get his own troops to follow him. That was almost scarier and worse than the fact that he and the president couldn't come to an agreement. You know, if he can't even get anything passed. But what I thought was a glimmer of hope, if I could put this out there, is this weekend, leaders of the Senate and the House are talking about returning to regular order on the budget. And that just hasn't happened for many years. The Senate just hasn't passed a budget. But now they're talking about doing some of these fiscal tax entitlement issues, which are absolutely essential to the economic agenda of President Obama and the Republicans, doing that through the regular order, going through committees and then through reconciliation with both houses.
And in our last minute, NPR's Nina Totenberg, it was a smooth ceremony, right? I feel like we've talked about substance. What about style?
I thought it was actually, in terms of a speech, it was a better speech than the first speech, and that the president seemed completely at ease with himself. The crowd may not have been as big, but it's a big crowd nonetheless. When you look and you compare it to other presidents and the crowds they've had, it's probably as big or bigger than most other presidents, in fact, bigger. And, you know, I do think that the sort of this was an interesting combination of grand themes and unity and a few little jabs in there.
Okay, and we may hear a few more jabs or an opportunity for some jabs because we're going to hear a Republican response to the president's inaugural address a little bit later on in this hour as we continue our live inaugural coverage from the West Front of the Capitol right here on NPR News.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of Inauguration Day 2013. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. In his second inaugural address, the president compared the oath he took today to one taken by soldiers signing up for duty or immigrants becoming Americans.
They are the words of citizens, and they represent our greatest hope. You and I, as citizens, have the power to set this country's course.
The president and vice president are inside the Capitol having lunch with congressional leaders and then the traditional parade along Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House and the challenges of another 4 years in the White House. In a few minutes, we're going to be, I believe, speaking with incoming Arizona Senator Jeff Flake. Senator Flake, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So a lot of the, first of all, you're, of course, a congressman becoming a senator out of the frying pan into the fire, so to speak. What is your response to the president's speech and message today?
Well, it's just great being here. What a wonderful institution this is, this inauguration, and it's just great to be a part of it.
If very different relationship, though, obviously, congressional Republicans, House Republicans in particular, battling with the president. And the Senate has been where, recently, deals have been made. And as you walk into this, what do you think can be different in the second term?
Well, I hope a couple of things that the president mentioned we can work on. He mentioned that we've got to get a hold of our debt and deficit. We do. That's going to require some work together. Also, immigration reform. He talked about recent immigrants becoming citizens. That's something we've got to do, and I had the opportunity to speak with the president briefly just a few minutes ago as he came into the Capitol, and that's certainly something that is important to Arizona.
Well, I'd like to know, Senator Flake, because these issues remind me, can remind you of something like the rhetoric about the middle class. Both the parties say essentially the same thing, but they mean something very different. If you look at those issues, the debt and the deficit, immigration reform, do you think that the parties are close enough that you could see real progress in the coming year?
On immigration reform, yes. On debt and deficit, it's going to be far more difficult. But immigration reform, that's something that Republicans realize we need to do, and I think Democrats do as well. We came close to getting it in 2007, so I think that will come. The debt and deficit is by far the bigger issue, the most important issue facing us. I hope we can sit down and reach an agreement there.
And those issues have been some of the most vehement battles in Congress. And I want to point to a line that President Obama said. He said, "We cannot mistake absolutism for principle or substitute spectacle for politics or treat name-calling as reasoned debate." Did you, your response to that line in the speech?
Well, I it's pretty aspirational. You know, it always works out somewhat differently. But I think that both sides bear blame here, and I hope that we can move ahead now that we've got a fresh start and get this done. We absolutely have to, or the markets are going to respond in a way that's not going to be pleasant for anybody. And so I think if there's any difference now than before, we're a lot closer to the real cliff, not the artificial cliff, but the real cliff that's going to come.
Well, let me ask about that, because you were a member of the House of Representatives during the last debt ceiling fight. Another one is looming now that you're in the United States Senate. Do you think that Republicans are willing to push this right to the edge, as they did last time, in order to get every cent that they can out of the president?
Well, the House has already signaled that they'll go for a three-month extension and hope that the Senate can actually produce a budget. That's something that's been missing for a couple of years now. Keep in mind that you know, the debt limit is certainly not the optimal leverage point. It's money that we have to pay. Obviously, it's debt that's already accrued. Having said that, the when we've had real statutory spending caps and real budget discipline, it's been when we reached agreement, like on Graham-Redmonds-Hollings in the late 80s, and that was pursuant to a debt limit increase, and that leverage was used effectively at that time. So I think the House and Senate ought to use whatever they can to force some kind of spending cuts. That's what we've got to do.
One other thing before I let you go, Senator Flake, I'm curious. This is the President's Day, obviously, but is there a line in this speech that you heard and you just thought, oh, he's just wrong about that? He's completely wrong about that.
Well, you know, on the debt and deficit, I think that there. I'll speak as a partisan Republican. We feel, and as a House member, we've put forward budgets. It's just been very frustrating. I think many of us have been willing to compromise, but we have yet to see the president really put a stake in the ground as to tell us where he is, so that we can say, here's where we are, here's where you are. Now let's compromise. When the Senate hasn't passed a budget, it's been difficult to do. So, like I said, I don't think that any party is blameless here. I just hope we can work together and get this thing solved.
There are some members of your party who have felt that compromise itself was wrong. Do you think your party is in a mood to compromise if the president comes to you with something that you could plausibly live with?
Yes, I think you've seen that in the past. And you know, Barry Goldwater once said, from my state, politics is nothing more than public business. Sometimes you make the best of a mixed bargain. I think we all recognize that's the case. Like I said, it's been a bit difficult because we haven't had a Senate budget. You know, we have had a House budget, but we haven't had a Senate budget to say, all right, here's where we can meet in the middle. It's just been difficult because it's kind of been a moving target.
Well, Senator Jeff Flake, thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Will do. Thank you so much.
Next, we're going to speak with Congressman Emanuel Cleaver. He's a Democrat from Missouri, former chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. Congressman Cleaver, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Now, we spoke a few weeks ago in talking about sort of expectations in particular from black Americans and also the ability of the Congressional Black Caucus to sort of criticize this president. Did you hear anything in this address that struck the tone you were looking for?
Well, you know, I think people come to these inaugurations listening for soaring rhetoric that will inspire us. And I think the president chose to not only have some words that were soaring and inspirational, but I think he laid out the very, very challenging work that is in front of him and this Congress. And I do think that the president, spoke to us in a powerful way, and some of the members of Congress sitting around me were saying, you know, the president actually did more of a State of the Union speech than what we usually hear in an inaugural speech, which I think lays the groundwork for the State of the Union a little later on. And hopefully people will, the members of Congress, that is, will understand that we have a fresh 4 years in front of us, and history will record whether we take advantage of it or whether we decide to duplicate what we've done the previous four, which is embarrassing.
And so many members of the Congressional Black Caucus are civil rights workers, heroes, John Lewis, for example. But can you talk a little bit about the history here, looking at compared to 4 years ago and today, which kind of falls on a holiday?
Well, today, much, much more so than 4 years ago, we saw the work of the civil rights movement and its leaders lifted up. The president started out, for example, asking the Martin Luther King family if he could be sworn in on Dr. King's Bible, and they agreed to do that. I thought that's powerful symbolism. It was on that same mall that Dr. King delivered the I Have a Dream speech. And so I think the president, more so than 4 years ago, sought to connect himself with not only Dr. King, but the civil rights movement. I mean, he spoke eloquently. And then to have Mrs. Evers deliver the invocation was another very strong sign of that desired connection. So I'm not saying that this was a civil rights rally in the tradition of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference during the 1960s and 50s and parts of the 70s. But the president was very clear in the attempt to connect with Dr. King and with those movements that allowed him to stand up today as the 45th president.
Congressman, one other thing. You mentioned the hope that the next 4 years can be productive, that you can get past some of the embarrassments of the past 4 years. I believe you used the word embarrassment to deal with some of the events of the last term. As you know, a lot of presidential second terms have turned out to actually be disappointments. Can you point us to something that would suggest to you that the president is poised for a good 4 years?
Well, let's be really clear, and I don't think many people will want to say this as candidly as I'm going to lay it out, but the president only has about 2 years. After 2 years, Congress is very likely going to become even more recalcitrant, and as well, not just Republicans, but Democrats are going to start gathering around the potential replacement, or certainly our the candidate we're going to bring forward, and people are going to be looking for their own agendas, and the president will have far less sway over Congress. That has nothing to do with Barack Obama. It has something to do with the system we have in place.
Yeah, we'll see if it even takes 2 years for that to happen, I suppose.
Well, I'm hoping for 2 years. But look, if we cannot get past sequestration, if we can't get this grand bargain, something similar to what Simpson Bowles proposed, if we can't get the debt ceiling raised, which I think we need to eliminate this whole process anyway, but if we can't get that raised, I think it bodes dangerously poorly for this second term. But it won't just reflect negatively on the president. I think it's going to reflect negatively on Congress, and perhaps some of this will spill over on the president.
And, of course, this conversation will continue as there's going to be a House vote on the debt ceiling in the coming days. Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Glad to talk with you.
We're going to go out to the National Mall now, where NPR's Jeff Brady is there. I'm getting my binocs out to see how far. Jeff, can you hear me?
I can hear you. And, you know, it's starting to clear out quite a bit here. We can actually see some of the grass on the National Mall again, much more trampled than when we got here at 5 o'clock
Goodness,
in the morning.
In some places, it's like you might be the last one left. It's been a very fast-moving crowd.
It is feeling a little bit lonely out here, but I have a few colleagues with me.
So who among the hardcore are you speaking to?
Well, you know, we've talked to so many people today, and that's really what I'm going to remember from this day, are the people who we've met. I just want to talk about one here, Barbara Better. She drove here from Milford, Delaware. She's volunteering today. She arrived at 5 o'clock in the morning. She came to the 2008 inauguration, and this time she brought a friend along who couldn't make it last time.
As far as the eye can see, there are people. Just people. You know, and looking at it on TV, it's not the same as in person. It just means so much more just to see all these people got up this morning to get here. It's amazing. It's just amazing.
I think you can get the enthusiasm that a lot of people here felt today. We've talked to so many people who made real sacrifices to be at this inauguration, people who drove for hours and hours or rode on charter buses from Michigan. They put up a very strict security around the National Mall, and people have had to deal with that, with terribly cold weather. But I really never heard anyone complaining about any of those things. It was all about the excitement of the day.
And I guess for many people, the question is what they do now and what happens next for the country, what happens next in Congress, and how, if at all, they'll be involved.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the questions I was asking a lot of people today is, what do you want to see from President Obama's second term? And I was surprised. The first six people I talked to, four of them mentioned gun control. I know it's a topic that the country is talking about now, but I really didn't expect people to mention that unprompted, and not all on one side of the issue either. I talked to a teenage girl from I'm trying to remember if it was Michigan or Ohio. I've talked to a lot of people today, and she said, you know, having hunting guns, hunting rifles in our state is really important to people, and we want to make sure that right is protected, but we also understand that there's an issue out there. That's an issue that a lot of people expect to be talked about here pretty soon. I cover energy for NPR, and so I was really interested to hear this one line in the president's speech. I talked about it a little while ago, but mm-hmm. I think it's worth mentioning. He said he talked about the path to sustainable energy sources being sometimes difficult, but that America cannot resist this transition but must lead it. And that's interesting to me because he's saying you can't cede that to other nations. And certainly you're seeing countries like China move ahead in the development and the production of the devices you need to produce renewable energy. So I'm going to be interested to see if that's leading to new policies or new regulations or new legislation. It's going to be interesting to see what comes out of that statement.
In just about 20 seconds, Jeff Brady, this is an issue where there's been a lot of controversy. You think about solar energy, you think about Solyndra, there have been scandals. Republicans have mocked the president's interest in windmills and alternative energy. When you get past that rhetoric, though, do you see room for potential deals being made, compromise, changes in Congress?
Well, boy, you know, if you talk to the people who are in this business, a lot of times they're just crying for help. Usually it's at the end of that period where the tax credits are just about to expire, and they want to see something more permanent, not this, approval to approval this year to the next year for tax credits. They want to see a long-term commitment to renewable sources of energy in this country, and that the president said he wants that too.
Go ahead.
NPR's Jeff Brady. Jeff, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
I want to bring in Mara Liasson, national political correspondent, and our Washington editor, Ron Elving. And guys, to start, you know, the website PolitiFact actually has been keeping track of first-term promises kept and made. The number they give is 46% of President Obama's promises were kept. The real stunner to me is that there were 500 promises that they counted. Looking at this speech, it seems like he's tackling a much smaller number.
It does, and it also seems as though he's being much more notional. But there will be more promises, and there will be more programmatic discussion. 3 weeks from now, we're going to have the State of the Union address, and in that State of the Union, much of what the president talked about today, that was substantive but sort of glancing blows as he moved quickly through 20 minutes, much of that is going to be fleshed out in much more detail, and there'll probably be some more promises made then. And then, of course, if you go back into the campaign, you will find many statements that were made in the form of a promise.
By notional, you mean he made a reference to immigration, for example, but nothing specific was laid on the table.
That's right. He didn't even talk about bringing back, for example, the DREAM Act, and specifically trying to press that forward again to put it in law. He had largely put it in effect by executive order in his last term, and I think that was one of the elements that really helped him with Hispanic voters.
We heard Emmanuel Cleaver say that he might only have 2 years. We've had other people suggest maybe more like 6 months.
Yeah, this is congressional math we're doing here.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're the president in this situation, do you have to focus on one or two things and know that that's all the chance you get?
Well, I think he is. He has a pretty ambitious agenda, but it's not huge and sprawling. I think it might have been Senator Flake who just said that he thought this was more like a State of the Union address. I actually thought this was more substantive and less purely thematic than a lot of inaugural addresses. He said what he wants to do. He wants to do something about global warming. We will act to respond to climate change. He wants to do immigration. He said, you know, young people shouldn't be expelled. He wants to do something about the budget deficit. And he mentioned Newtown, didn't specifically talk about that. But I thought what was interesting where he says, progress does not compel us to settle centuries-long debates about the role of government for all time. But it does require us to act in our time. In other words, let's just get something done. We're not going to settle this huge divide in American politics, but I'm going to get done what I can. And I think he really did. He does have a sense of urgency because he knows that whether it's 6 months or 18 months, nobody quite knows how long he's got, he doesn't have a lot of time before he becomes a true lame duck.
Listening to Senator Flake, Republican, Emmanuel Cleaver, the Democrat, did you hear signs of common ground at all?
Sure. On immigration? Yes.
Okay.
I don't know about anything else.
All right. That's Mara Liasson and Ron Elving joining us as we continue our live coverage of President Obama's inauguration on this Martin Luther King holiday. We're going to have more after a short break right here on NPR News. We have more special coverage of Inauguration Day 2013. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Audie Cornish. On the day the country celebrates the life of Martin Luther King Jr., President Obama publicly took the oath of office for a second term in the White House.
As we mentioned, hundreds of thousands of people, many waving small American flags, withstood the January cold. Wasn't too bad a day here on the National Mall. At the start of the inaugural ceremony, Merle Evers Williams, the wife of slain civil rights leader Medgar Evers, delivered the invocation.
We ask that you grant our president the will to act courageously but cautiously when confronted with danger, and to act prudently but deliberately when challenged by adversity.
That was Merle Evers Williams. She gave the invocation during the inaugural ceremony. We're going to turn now to NPR's Don Gagne. He's at the Lincoln Memorial. And Don, Miss Merle Evers Williams, of course, a direct link to the civil rights era, and of course, at the Lincoln Memorial, also a link to the civil rights era.
Exactly, and the Lincoln Memorial is busier than it has been all day. A lot of people stopped here on their way to the inauguration, and now it seems like even more people have decided, you know, it's early, let's go pay a visit. Let's go read Mr. Lincoln's second inaugural address. Let's go stand on the steps where Dr. King delivered the I Have a Dream speech during the March on Freedom in 1963, August. A crowd of people standing there right now. So it's become a very popular place on the Mall, even though it was a little sleepy earlier.
And you mentioned that people were actually looking at the speech on their phones. I know there are fewer Jumbotrons than there used to be, but is this a case where the budget cutback showed?
Well, I think also some of the Jumbotrons cut out, we are told by people, at least temporarily. And we talked to people who are heading back to Lincoln, watching the speech on their iPhone. And when we got here, as the speech was underway, there was a group of people huddled over in the corner, seated on these cold steps, listening on the radio. There were iPads up. It was pretty easy to watch the speech over here. And I guess it was about a 30-second buffer delay, even as it was happening live a few miles to the east across the mall.
And Don, of course, you covered the Bush administration for a very long time, and I feel like I should ask you sort of how you think this compares to that second inaugural speech.
Well, you know, in some ways, the speeches both tried to do the same thing. They both tried to speak to very big things. For President Bush, you may recall that his first inaugural was under very contentious times. He hadn't won the popular vote. A lot of people thought he was an imposter. And again, it was a very complicated speech and moment in American politics. 4 years ago, he felt much better. He'd been reelected, and he delivered a big thematic speech, mostly about foreign policy, about his freedom agenda around the world. And again, it was his attempt to kind of go big and use some of the soaring rhetoric that he was not particularly known for. We also saw President Obama try to speak in much loftier language than we've heard from him in quite some time, I think.
Although there's a distinction, Don Gagne, President Bush in 2005 felt that he was in position to make huge changes in the country. We did hear this president, after the lofty language, after the determined statements about global warming and some other things, essentially say, we don't have to resolve all problems for all time. We can figure it out for now. We can make some progress. There was a kind of modesty to this speech in places.
No, I think so. And I don't want to take the comparison too far beyond kind of the fact that both did kind of reach for something big in terms of the tone and the feel. But at its core, it felt like this was a political speech. You heard a lot of what you heard during the Obama presidential campaigns in this speech. And it also recognized that there are many dirty, ugly, difficult, brutal battles to come. And as you've talked about, there was the call to action to his supporters that their work isn't done. We've heard that in past speeches as well. We'll see if he is successful in mobilizing those forces that were just so effective and powerful during actual campaigns.
I'm just making a note of all your adjectives there, Don. Dirty, ugly, difficult, brutal battles.
And those were the bright spots, right?
And those are the bright spots.
It's NPR's Don Gagne at the Lincoln Memorial. Thanks, Don.
My pleasure.
And we turn to Netta Ulaby, who's out earlier in the day. And Netta, I hear you're warm now, which I won't hold against you. Talk about what you saw out there.
Well, I was hanging out with the people who were getting ready to march in the parade. And clearly an attempt was made to capture the composition of the country. It was quite a wide assortment of people, lots of military marching bands. There was an equine therapy group that was represented from Wisconsin. A bunch of Native American dance groups.
I'm sorry, I just got to stop you right there.
Where to begin?
Equine therapy. What is it?
Well, I did not meet these particular people.
Okay,
but
fine. Go on.
Well, they were described as building self-confidence through equine therapy. They were there.
Okay.
Connecticut sent a really cool restored World War II-era ambulance. And one high school from La Jolla, Texas, sent a mariachi and folkloric group. And we recorded them warming up in the Pentagon parking lot. Now, if you imagine a Mexican folkloric band, you're probably imagining glamorous women in very swirly dresses that were not exactly designed for 30-degree weather. So I asked a couple of the dancers how they were bracing for the cold.
Thermals. Leggings.
Thermals. Leggings.
Everything was fine, you know?
Under Armour.
That's Maria Nieves and Connie Benavides from the Ballet Folklorico de la Raza from Colorado Springs. I heard they're a mother and grandmother, by the way, and their group includes several generations from the same family, with the youngest being 7 and the oldest 63 years old.
And Under Armour aside, these are coveted spots, right, Netta? I mean, it's very competitive getting into this parade.
Really competitive. Almost 3,000 groups applied for inclusion, and that's more than double than with the last inauguration 4 years ago. I talked to a high school band who told me that they found out only a month ago that they were going to be picked, and they had to scramble like mad to raise enough money. One group from Palm Springs raised $100,000 in a week so that they could represent their entire state, California. And I also talked to some soldiers about how they got to be picked to march in the parade. Ashley Moore is Assistant Logistics Officer at the Marine Barracks in Washington, and this is how she says she got chosen to march.
We were just chosen by our command. They tell us you have certain height requirements, and then they just ask, and we do lots of practices, so the best marchers are out there.
What makes a good marcher?
Someone that can stand on their feet for a long time, I would definitely say. You keep up with the tempo as well.
Officer Moore, by the way, confessed to feeling very hot in her dress uniform. So all of those colorful costumes are much more pleasant to look at than to be wearing on your body.
Okay, fine. If one person was hot today, apparently also a tall person as well, that's just fine. Good for her. Good for her.
Netta, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We're actually going to speak now with Tamara Keith, our congressional correspondent, because she's on watch for the congressional lunch that's happening. President Obama and Vice President were sitting down with lawmakers. And Tamara, to start, tell us a bit about the tradition of this lunch. What's going to go on there?
Yeah, so this lunch dates back a very long time. The original idea is that, you know, the president might need a snack after being sworn in. And now it has grown into this thing that is full of pageantry. It's a hot guest list to be on, and you know every single detail is very carefully crafted.
And is this the kind of event where there's going to be remarks as well, either from lawmakers or from the vice president or president?
Yes, there are remarks. That brief though they may be, they actually shushed us out of there before the remarks started because. I guess they didn't want us to see people eating. I guess perhaps the media watching people eat is not polite. But I can tell you some things about the menu. It's a lovely menu, including lobster and clam chowder and bison and apple tarts with maple syrup and honey. It's reportedly about 3,000 calories.
Okay, 3,000 calories. That'll get you through a cold day. Let me ask, though, Tamara Keith, because you have the president sitting down with Republican and Democratic members of Congress. This is a president who was asked at his last big news conference about the notion that he's standoffish, that he hasn't spent enough time schmoozing with Republicans and others in order to get deals done. The president, as you'll recall, said, look, I'm a pretty friendly guy, but that doesn't, I'm paraphrasing, but that doesn't stop them from calling me a socialist. I'd like to know, based on your reporting, even though they won't let you into the lunch, based on your reporting, when these guys get together in a room, do they get along at all?
And we were actually able to see them walking in, at least. In one of these situations, as with many situations with the president, he basically walks up to the head table and sits down and doesn't really get a lot of opportunity to schmooze or display that he's not a stick in the mud, as I think he called himself. But, you know, within the room, it is fascinating. Obviously, it's not just the president and the speaker who make deals. It's people at lower levels and just the different table arrangements, different people sitting together. Definitely, there was some strategy involved. We had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff sitting at the same table as the chairman of the Armed Services Committee in the House. Mitch McConnell sitting with Jimmy Carter.
Senate Republican leader.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting. Okay, so thanks very much, Tamara Keith. The president will move from that lunch to the inaugural parade, which will proceed northwestward from here.
And the person with the best view of that parade for us is NPR's Linda Wertheimer. Hi there, Linda.
Hi there.
So describe the scene in front of you.
We are at the Canadian Embassy, which has a beautiful porch in the front. And we're sitting right at the point of it. So we're looking down Pennsylvania Avenue toward, down Constitution toward the Capitol, and then back up Pennsylvania. And the crowds are already beginning to gather. I think they come right out of the inaugural crowd and then line up on the street after they spend a little time trying to thaw out and visiting the roughly 1,000 porta-potties that are immediately in this vicinity.
You counted, I'm sure. You would not put out a figure like that if it was not absolutely true.
Certainly not.
But let me just ask, because Netta Ulaby mentioned earlier about the careful choice of people to be in this parade, an effort to make sure that the parade represents America. This is clearly, it's part of a larger civic event. It's not your ordinary parade. What is the meaning that an administration tries to convey, that an inaugural committee tries to convey, that Washington tries to convey with a ceremony like this?
Well, of course, there are people who are representing the president, the vice president, and their own states. There will be floats for the members of the president, for the first lady, the president, and the second lady and the vice president. They will have floats and bands and marching units from their home states. There is an obvious effort to put a lot of Hispanic units in the parade. And there are also, of course, you would naturally get, with high school bands and that kind of thing, you would naturally get young people. But there are also children's units marching in the parade. I myself am very interested in the, there's a children's circus unit, which is coming in from Maine, that I think ought to be wonderful to see. And then, of course, as you mentioned, the equine, there's an equine unit, which is a, it has a very peculiar name.
The equine therapy unit, are you referring
yes,
to?
Yes, equine
second reference of the show.
Self-confidence experience. But we also have, there's a unit of dogs coming along. I mean, I think this whole thing is going to be very interesting, but you can, as you go down the line, you can clearly see states that were of special interest in this election. Battleground states are well represented. And people from, people whose areas were helpful to the president and vice president in this campaign. So it's a political as well as an effort to sort of extend across the country. And all kinds of cultures, the Gullah Geechee Cultural Heritage Corridor Commission from South Carolina, marching bands, several marching bands from Hawaii, including Punahou High School.
And that'll have to be our final thought. Thanks very much, NPR's Linda Wertheimer. We'll be listening for you as the parade gets underway.
As we wrap up this hour, a little review of the president's second swearing-in.
On a brisk winter morning in Washington, hundreds of thousands of people filled the National Mall.
With a touch of pomp, the ceremony began.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States, Barack H. Obama, accompanied by Staff Director for the Joint Commission.
The inauguration was on a national holiday today, also honors the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King, and the ceremony did that as well.
The invocation was given by Merle Evers Williams, the wife of slain civil rights activist Medgar Evers.
And the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir followed with the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Vice President Biden was sworn in by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, and then Chief Justice John Roberts publicly swore in the president to a second term.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
This is the obligatory moment when we mention that Chief Justice Roberts had a little trouble with the oath last time, but this time around, they made it through without stepping on each other.
Congratulations, Mr. President. Well done.
And the 44th President of the United States gave his second inaugural speech to the crowd, paid respect to Dr. King, and repeatedly hit upon three words that begin the Constitution.
We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still, just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall, just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints along this great mall, to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone, to hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth.
The president stayed away from specifics, but he did give hints of the big issues ahead.
He talked about climate change, he mentioned gay marriage, he mentioned immigration and the legislative fight over gun control.
Our journey is not complete until all our children, from the streets of Detroit to the hills of Appalachia to the quiet lanes of Newtown, know that they are cared for and cherished, and always safe from harm.
And President Obama finished by acknowledging the likely gridlock and bitter arguments ahead, and in a sense welcoming it.
We must act knowing that today's victories will be only partial, and that it will be up to those who stand here in 4 years, and 40 years, and 400 years hence to advance the timeless spirit once conferred to us in a spare Philadelphia hall.
Beyonce belted out the national anthem to close the ceremony.
What a land of the free and the home of the brave. The brave.
The national anthem at the end of the inaugural ceremony, an event for the president, an event for the nation at the end of a partisan election, a civic event. And Audie, if I'm thinking through the different themes of the speech, a couple of words come to mind. We heard that phrase about victories will be partial. There's a kind of resignation in this speech that we can only accomplish so much, that this president can only accomplish so much of what he wants to do. And yet at the same time, as Mara Liasson pointed out earlier in our coverage, a determination to stake out large goals once again, to talk about doing something about climate change, however difficult or near impossible that may politically be.
It's important to note, NPR's Ari Shapiro earlier in the day noted to us that President Obama's staff was very much still working today, you know, even though it's a holiday, and I think that says a lot here. And also we spoke to Republican and Democrat lawmakers today, both of which were already dropping those words we've been hearing for the last week, sequestration, debt ceiling, you know, it was just kind of like the vocabulary was so strong. So obviously a lot of obstacles in the next few weeks even.
It's a reminder that this particular inauguration is not a period or an exclamation point. It's a comma or maybe a semicolon.
An ellipsis, maybe.
An ellipsis. Thank you very much. And we will see what comes after this. We'll continue covering it throughout the day and throughout the weeks ahead. Thanks very much, Audie Cornish. I've enjoyed this.
Pleasure being with you.
You're listening to special coverage of the inauguration from NPR News.